I checked its engine, which seemed clean and in good repair, and made sure of the fuel. When I was satisfied, I put my pack in, seated Savard in, and then climbed into the pilot's seat. 2 days after the storm, the snow moss was beginning to show again. Sweeps of pale green, with darker threads here and there. After 2 more hours, we flew over a line of hills, and the green darkened dramatically, lined and irregularly veined in 12 shades, like malachite. In some places, the moss was smeared and trampled by the creatures that grazed on it, herds of long-haired bove making their way southward as spring advanced. And along those paths, on the edges here and there, ice devils lay in carefully tunneled lairs, waiting for a bove to put a foot wrong so they could drag it down. I saw no trace of them, but even the herders who lived their lives following the bove couldn't always tell when one was near. It was easy flying. Savardin sat half lying and quiet beside me. How could she be alive? And how had she ended up here now? It was beyond improbable. But improbable things happened. Nearly 1,000 years before Lieutenant Onn was even born, Savardin had captained a ship of her own, Sword of Naphtas, and had lost it. Most of the human crew, including Savardin, had managed to get to an escape pod. But hers had never been found, that I had heard. Yet here she was. Someone must have found her relatively recently. She was lucky to be alive. I was 4 billion miles away when Savardin lost her ship. I was patrolling a city of glass and polished red stone, silent but for the sound of my own feet, and the conversation of my lieutenants, and, occasionally, me trying my voices against the echoing pentagonal plazas. Falls of flowers, red and yellow and blue, draped the walls surrounding houses with 5-sided courtyards. The flowers were wilting. No one dared walk the streets except me and my officers. Everyone knew the likely fate of any person placed under arrest. Instead, they huddled in their houses, waiting for what would come next, wincing or shuddering at the sound of a lieutenant laughing, or my singing. What trouble we'd run into, I and my lieutenants, had been sporadic. The Garcetti had put up only nominal resistance. Troop carriers had emptied, the Swords and Mercies were essentially on guard duty around the system. Representatives from the 5 zones of each of the 5 regions, 25 in all, speaking for the various moons, planets, and stations in the Garcetti system, had surrendered in the name of their constituents and were separately on their way to Sword of Amat to meet Anander Mienai, Lord of the Roch, and beg for the lives of their people. Hence, that frightened, silent city. In a narrow diamond-shaped park, by a black granite monument inscribed with the 5 right actions, and the name of the Garcetti patron who had wished to impress them on the local residents, one of my lieutenants passed another and complained that this annexation had been disappointingly dull. 3 seconds later, I received a message from Captain Savardin's Sword of Naphtas. The 3 Garcetti electors she was carrying had killed 2 of her lieutenants, and 12 of Sword of Naphtas's ancillary segments. They had damaged the ship, cut conduits, breached the hull. Accompanying the report, a recording from Sword of Naphtas, the gun that an ancillary segment saw irrefutably, but that according to Sword of Naphtas's other sensors, just didn't exist. A Garcetti elector, against all expectations, surrounded by the gleaming silver of Rodchai-style armor that only the ancillary's eyes could see, firing the gun, the bullet piercing the ancillary's armor, killing the segment and, with its eyes gone, the gun and armor flickering back into non-existence. All the electors had been searched before boarding, and Sword of Naphtas should have been able to detect any weapon or shield-generating device or implant. And while Rajchai-style armor had once been in common use in the regions surrounding the Rach itself, those regions had been absorbed 1,000 years before. The Garcetti didn't use it, didn't know how to make it, let alone how to use it. And even if they had, that gun and its bullet were flatly impossible. 3 people armed with such a gun and armored could do a great deal of damage on a ship like Sword of Naphtas, especially if even 1 Garcetti could reach the engine, and if such a gun could pierce the engine's heat shield. Rajchai warship engines burned star hot, and a failed heat shield meant instant vaporization, an entire ship dissolved in a brief bright flash. But there was nothing I could do, nothing anyone could do. The message was nearly 4 hours old, a signal from the past, a ghost. The issue had been decided even before it had reached me. A harsh tone sounded, and a blue light blinked on the panel in front of me, beside the fuel indicator. An instant before, the indicator had read nearly full. Now it read empty. The engine would shut down in a matter of minutes. Beside me, Savard sprawled, relaxed and quiet. I landed. The fuel tank had been rigged in a way I hadn't detected. It seemed 3/4 full, but it wasn't, and the alarm that ought to have sounded when I'd used half of what I'd started with had been disconnected. I thought of the double deposit I certainly wouldn't see again, of the proprietor, so concerned that she might lose her valuable flyer. Of course there would be a transmitter, whether or not I triggered the emergency call. The proprietor wouldn't want to lose the flyer, just strand me alone in the middle of this plain of moss-streaked snow. I could call for help. I had disabled my communication implants, but I did have a handheld I could use. But we were very, very far from anyone who might be moved to send assistance. And even if help came, and came before the proprietor, who clearly meant me no good, I wouldn't get where I was going, a matter of great importance to me. The air was minus 18 degrees. The breeze from the south, at approximately 8 kph, implied snow sometime in the near future. Nothing serious, if the morning's weather report could be trusted. My landing had left a green-edged smear of white in the snow moss, easily visible from the air. The terrain seemed gently hilly, though hills we'd flown over were no longer visible. Had this been an ordinary emergency, the best course would have been to stay inside the flyer until help came. But this wasn't an ordinary emergency, and I didn't expect rescue. Either they would come as soon as their transmitter told them we were grounded, prepared to murder, or they would wait. The rental had several other vehicles. The proprietor would likely not be inconvenienced if she waited even several weeks to retrieve her flyer. As she herself had said, no one would be surprised if a foreigner lost herself in the snow. I had 2 choices. I could wait here and hope to ambush anyone who came to murder and rob me, and take their transport. This would, of course, be futile in the event that they decided to wait for cold and hunger to do their job for them. Or I could pull Savard in out of the flyer, shoulder my pack, and walk. My intended destination was some 60 kilometers to the southeast. I could walk that in a day if I had to, ground and weather, and ice devils permitting. But I would be lucky if Savardin could do it in twice that time. And that course would be futile if the proprietor decided not to wait, but to retrieve her flyer more or less immediately. Our trail through the moss-striated snow would be clear. They would need only to follow us and dispose of us. I would have lost any advantage of surprise I might have gained by hiding near the downed flyer. And I would be lucky if I found anything once I reached my destination. I had spent the past 19 years following the most tenuous of threads, weeks and months of searching or waiting, punctuated by moments like this, when success, or even life, hung on the toss of a coin. I had been lucky to come this far. I couldn't reasonably expect to go farther. A Rodchai would have tossed that coin, or more accurately, a handful of them. A dozen discs, each with its meaning and import, the pattern of their fall, a map of the universe as Amat willed it to be. Things happen the way they happen because the world is the way it is. Or, as a Rodchai would say, the universe is the shape of the gods. Amat conceived of light, and conceiving of light also necessarily conceived of not light, and light and darkness sprang forth. This was the first emanation, a trepabo, light, darkness. The other three implied and necessitated by the first are Eskvar, beginning, ending, Issa Inu, movement, stillness, and Van Eter, existence, non-existence. These four emanations variously split and recombined to create the universe. Everything that is emanates from Amat. The smallest, most seemingly insignificant event is part of an intricate whole, and to understand why one particular mote of dust falls in one particular path and lands in one particular location is to understand the will of Amat. There is no such thing as just a coincidence. Nothing happens by chance, but only according to the mind of God. Or so official Rodchai orthodoxy teaches. I myself have never understood religion very well. It was never required that I should. And though the Rodchai had made me, I wasn't Rodchai. I knew and cared nothing about the will of the gods. I only knew that I would land where I myself had been cast, wherever that would be. I took my pack from the flyer, opened it, and removed an extra magazine, which I stowed inside my coat near my gun. I shouldered the pack, went around to the other side of the flyer, and opened the hatch there. "Sevardin," I said. She didn't move, only breathed a quiet, "Hmm." I took her arm and pulled, and she half-slid, half-stepped, out into the snow. I had gotten this far by taking one step and then another. I turned northeast, pulling Sevardin along, and walked. Dr. Aerolesperus Stregan, whose home I very much hoped I was walking toward, had been, at one time, a medic in private practice on Dras Ania Station, an aggregation of at least 5 different stations, one built onto another, at the intersection of 2 dozen different routes, well outside Roch territory. Nearly anything could end up there, given enough time, and in the course of her work, she had met a wide variety of people with a wide variety of antecedents. She had been paid in currency, in favors, in antiques, in nearly anything that might imaginably be said to have value. I'd been there, seen the station and its convoluted, interpenetrating layers, seen where Stregan had worked and lived, seen the things she'd left behind when one day, for no reason anyone seemed to know, she'd bought passage on 5 different ships and then disappeared. A case full of stringed instruments, only 3 of which I could name, 5 shelves of icons, a dizzying array of gods and saints worked in wood, in shell, in gold. 12 guns, each one carefully labeled with its station permit number. These were collections that had begun as single items, received in payment, sparking her curiosity.